All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from New York City on this, the 17th of November, 2020. I want to thank each of you for listening to this show, making it one of the more popular shows in the Voice America Business Channel, and also want to encourage you to keep your questions, any comments you might have, send them along to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. I do like to encourage you to consider signing up for my newsletter. It's a weekly letter as well as a monthly letter that focuses primarily on the mining sector, the exploration sector primarily, gold and silver with the focus there. But we also send out a monthly letter, and we did send out our November monthly letter this morning. Encourage you also to consider signing up for Chen Lin's letter, What is Chen Buying, What is Chen Selling? Chen Lin's website, and his that escapes my memory at the moment. But you look him up and you'll find him, Chen Lin. What is Chen Buying, What is Chen Selling? We'd like to also suggest that you consider Michael Oliver's work. He will not be with us today. I expect we'll have Michael with us next week. It's olivermsa.com, olivermsa.com. Chenpicks.com. It just came to my mind. Chenpicks.com is a place to go for Chen Lin's letter. Also want to thank our sponsors for making this show economically viable. Our sponsors for this week are Benchmark Metals, NV Gold, Hannon Metals, Irving Resources, Novo Resources, Lion One Metals, Grand Portage, GMV Minerals, SK Mining Corp, and Cassiar Gold Mining, Cassiar Gold Corp. I've titled today's show, Why Inflation is on the Horizon. Lynn Alden returns and Marco Rock visits for the first time. Corwin Coe of Sitco was supposed to be with us today, but he was unable to join me because of a major storm that's occurring on the West Coast. He did send me an email shortly before the show, and I spoke to him briefly on his cell phone, which is very rapidly declining with the energy that he has left in the phone, and so he just felt that he couldn't be with us. He said he traveled downtown Vancouver and saw all the lights were out, the stoplights, everything, so there's a major storm at least on that part of the West Coast, and that has put Corwin out of commission with us today. However, he did send along some notes. Things are moving along very nicely for Corwin Coe's company, Sitka Gold, and they're doing extremely well on their exploration efforts. They are a sponsor to this show. I'm not sure that I mentioned that a moment ago. He sent along this email, he said, the storm is just really crazy. I'm not going to be able to be with you today. He said that they are very excited about the company's prospects moving forward and expects to have additional drill results from their RC Gold project in the Yukon any time now. And he does expect sometime this week to have something out, he tells me, and then again next week. And I should say that they did have a very impressive early drill result of 139 meters grading 0.619 grams of gold per ton. I know that Corwin is extremely excited about the Yukon project. That's of the three that he has, that's the one he's really most bullish on. And I think what's really important to focus on is this is a company that has three projects that are being drilled. It's got a market cap of around $11 million in U.S. money, or in Canadian money, actually. To me, it's one of the most underpriced, promising exploration stocks that I follow, and it is one of my major holdings personally. The company is also starting a major marketing program so there are going to be more eyeballs on this stock. So if people start to realize its value, you could see an appreciation on that, along with some really good drill results, which I am anticipating. Now, the company also will be providing some information from its Burrow Creek gold project, and it's a gold and silver project in Arizona. That's the most advanced project the company has. Very promising, a lot of upside exploration there. The real wild card for this company is the Alpha Gold project in Nevada. And indeed, the company had drilled one deep drill hole, and the drill hole wandered off in the wrong direction to a great extent. But they did get a lot of information, a lot of geological information that they think is going to be very helpful. They're seeing some very promising signs in their search for a Carlin-style gold deposit there in Nevada along the Cortez Trend. I should mention, I noted that Michael will not be with us today, but I should say that he did talk a little bit. I'll just pass along a couple of his ideas that he passed along this weekend, in his November 15 missive on gold. He said, despite the very sharp decline in the price of gold with the recent vaccine news, which really set the equity market soaring and I guess gave people less reason to think they need to own gold, he says that Michael expressed no worries at all about gold. He said, and I quote, "At present, there are simply no structures to break that are within shouting distance. Therefore, MSA does not think gold is at a top," end of quote. And then he went on to say that he would not be surprised to see a peak in gold of around $10,000 or so per ounce over the next year or two. At that point, at some point in time, he believes that his momentum work will provide a very definite exit point. Just as one who watches and reads Michael's daily missives, almost daily, not every day, but very often, many times during the week he'll send out his charts and his commentary, and it's almost always very, very helpful in terms of knowing when to stay in something and when to get out. Now, he's not for short-term traders, but if you take a longer-term investment viewpoint, I don't know of anybody, never has anybody been better for me personally. As a technical analyst, never has there been a better technical analyst for me personally than Michael Oliver in his work. And time and time again, when lots of people were getting nervous about gold, Michael's work said, no, nothing to fear, stay with it. But just as surely, when the time comes to get out, he'll be telling us that too. And his call back in 2012, he got out in very good time, not at the exact peak, but certainly I wished that I had been following him at that time. I'm sure my portfolio would have fared much better. Well, as I mentioned, Lynn Alden is going to be with us, and we're going to talk to her about the inflation-deflation issues, the prospects. When you have trillions of dollars being printed, a lot of people think that's just a slam dunk for inflation. Well, it may not be so. It's more complicated than that. Fiscal policy, or not fiscal policy, may come into play. Lots of different parameters, different things that could take place that will be important to discuss with Lynn, and we'll get her thoughts on that. And I want to ask her a little bit about Bitcoin, too, because it seems as though Lynn has turned somewhat bullish on Bitcoin, and so I want to have a discussion with her about that. What does she feel about the vaccines, and to what extent will that help turn things around? Is everything going to be honky-dory now that we're promised a vaccine that's going to be on this provided to us very soon, within a number of months? Those and many more questions we'll be asking Lynn about. Now, we are going to go to a commercial break now, but don't go away, because we're going to talk to Marco Rock. He is the CEO of a new and very exciting company that I've just recently started coverage in my newsletter on. That's Cassiar Gold Corp. And Marco will be with me right after the break. So please don't go away. We'll be right back then.
Be become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Benchmark Metals is an advanced gold-silver exploration company that is rapidly advancing its Canadian gold-silver project to a production decision. Benchmark is nearing completion of its largest program to date, with up to 100,000 meters of resource expansion and definition drilling in 2020. The multi-million ounce potential project is expected to have a new mineral resource estimate and PEA study completed in 2021. The company is backed by the Metals Group management team and believes this aggressive program will be complemented by one of the strongest commodity bull markets in decades. Visit BenchmarkMetals.com and subscribe to follow their success.
Cassiar Gold Corp. trades on the OTCQB under the symbol CGLCF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol GLDC. Its flagship asset, the Cassiar Gold Project, is a large advanced-stage, road-accessible gold property with an NI 43-101-compliant resource estimate of 1 million ounces at 1.43 grams per ton gold at the Taurus near-surface bulk tonnage gold deposit and 15 kilometers of high-grade gold prospects. The property hosts several past-producing high-grade gold mines and is in search for the next multi-million-ounce gold camp in British Columbia.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me for the first time, Marco Rock. He is the CEO and director of Cassiar Gold Corp. It's a new sponsor to this show. Cassiar Gold Corp. trades in Toronto under the symbol GLDC, and it trades down here in the United States. You can buy it under the symbol CGLCF. 54 million shares outstanding at around Canadian 56 cents gives it a market cap of around $30 million in Canadian money. Now, Marco started his career in private banking with Millennium BCP. That's a large Portuguese bank. And then he joined Barclays Capital in 2007, where for several years he spearheaded the Portuguese derivatives and structured products team with a focus on commodities. And he is a co-founder of Reyna Silver. It's a name that I think some of our listeners would be familiar with. And it's a silver exploration company with a portfolio of Mexican silver assets built around two assets that formed part of MAG Silver's original IPO. And Marco is also a co-founder and director of Arabian Shield Resources. That's a private mining company engaged in the acquisition, exploration, development of mining assets in the Arabian-Nubian Shield and surrounding regions of the Middle East. He is a CFA charter holder, earned an MBA from Hong Kong University of Science and Technology and London Business School, a master's in finance from Nova School of Business and Economics in Lisbon, as well as an undergraduate management degree from that same school. Welcome, Marco. It's really good to have you with us.
Thank you, Jay. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to hear this story, and I know that I told you I'm somewhat familiar with that Cassiar Mountains and the project years ago, but let's get right to your story. You have and you know, in spite of the fact you've got a market cap of, as I just said, $30 million, you already have a resource, a 43-101 resource of a little over a million ounces grading 1.43. This would be an open pittable deposit. Also on your very large property, I know there are some very high-grade gold mining projects in the past on a small scale, but nonetheless very high-grade underground vein systems that exist there. Well, since this is the first time that you're telling a story, maybe I could just ask you, give our listeners an overview of your project in northern BC and what your plans are as we head into 2021.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jay. Yeah, as you mentioned, Cassiar Gold is a Canadian explorer. Our flagship asset, Cassiar Gold, is located in northern BC. It hosts a foundational resource, 1 million ounces at 1.43 grams per ton, for 3101 compliance. It's a flat-lying, near-surface resource with almost no overburden that is surrounded by infrastructure. We have Highway 37 bisecting our property. Actually, the resource itself starts literally next to the highway. We have a permitted mill on site. We have multiple access roads. We have a camp. We have tailings. We have mine permits. And, you know, as you were mentioning valuation, we are, you know, taking all of that into consideration, relatively undervalued compared to our peers. And then very excitingly, we also have a really, really world-class team. We have names like Doug Kerwin, David Reese, James Maxwell, Steve Ledwin, and Chris Stewart in both our board and advisory board. So in addition to that, to what we already have, we have the potential to increase our bulk tonnage resource. That's our 43101 resource, and which we are, you know, just completed a drilling campaign, and we'll be receiving results. So that's potential to increase that. But then, as you also mentioned, on the South Cassiar part of our property, we also have very high-grade targets. And this is these typical orogenic gold deposit systems, high-grade gold and quartz veins, 15 to 25 gram per ton material that has the potential to be stacked for, you know, for long, you know, up to a kilometer, even more. So the old timers in the 80s and 90s scratched the surface and produced some very high grade. And our goal for 2021 is really to go to that part of our property, which is, you know, roughly 5 kilometers south of our resource, and really start building a high grade resource in addition to our bulk tonnage resource, for which we actually already have an historical resource that that's in, 24 gram per ton material, but just under 100,000 ounces. So it's a really exciting opportunity with, you know, multiple avenues to grow.
Indeed. Well, I'm familiar with one company that I covered in my newsletter decades ago, Marco. Cusack Industries is the name of the company. But I actually visited that property, and I saw they were mining really just really following the veins. They were high grade, very high grade. Quartz veins underground, and they didn't really look at it the way people explore and develop things these days. Probably, I guess you're looking at it in a larger scope. Like, what are you doing exploration-wise to sort of take the big picture and look at what you've got there south, where those high-grade vein systems are known to exist?
Absolutely. This part of the property, South Cassia or Table Mountain, this is where we have the historical production. The historical production, most of it was, you know, 17, 18, 20, 25 grams per ton. So, you know, as you mentioned, very high grade. I think in the past, you know, the companies that operated it never had this, like, big picture, you know, perspective to see, you know, what is the system that is feeding all of this. And we've added to our advisory team over the last few months, we've added Doug Kerwin, and we added David Reese as well. They're highly successful geologists, multiple awards and discoveries that have worked in the biggest orogenic gold systems in the world. And they recognize the potential there for a multi-million ounce, stack system of veins, not dissimilar to what you see in Barkerville from Osisko in British Columbia, or in Fosterville down in Victoria in Australia, where, you know, you have in the 1900s people, you know, mining, you know, they think that's okay, we've mined the things that are very close to surface, let's move on to something better. But actually, when you have a proper look and start understanding the system, there's, you know, these systems can really provide the potential for a multi-million ounce high grade that just keeps on giving. So that's really our focus. And next year, we're designing a 15,000-meter program to really start scratching the surface and going a little bit deeper and, you know, trying to uncover that multi-million ounce potential.
Well, certainly you've added a structural geologist recently, I know, and it's all about the technical team. When you get these large-scale systems, they can be quite complicated. I know that people, exploration companies, have the ability now with the technology they didn't have when I started writing my newsletter 30 years ago or so. Now it's easier to see the big picture than it was back in those days. Getting back to your existing resource, I know you just put out some numbers, you put out some assays, I think perhaps four different assays, and it looks like you're filling in, sort of doing infill drilling. And is there a chance that you might expand that deposit with your work this year yet, or is that something that you'll look to do next year, or what are you doing with the open pittable, bulk mineable target that we're talking about, the 1 million ounces?
Yeah, absolutely. So the bulk tonnage resource, or the bulk tonnage part of our property, so Taurus, was really the focus for this year's drilling campaign. So we've drilled 5,000 meters with the goal of, you know, confirming, infilling, and expanding our resource. So the resource itself at the beginning of the season was open in multiple directions. There were some gaps in the resource model. You know, most of the drill holes were exploration and expansion. There was a little bit that it was infill. So we already have the first 7 drill holes out out of the 24 drill hole campaign, and we are, you know, they are very significant and very positive to us. So they've confirmed the historical results. We also had a gap in the model that we've intercepted mineralization, so it lends itself to expanding that gap or adding that gap to the resource. The drill hole, you know, all the first 7 drill holes intercepted mineralization, and the grades actually of the intercepts are actually also higher than the grade from the resource. So we feel very good from this first set of drill holes. We're very excited for what's coming next as well, the rest of the drill holes which will be coming out over the next few weeks. But I can consider this exploration program already a success. And at the end of this drilling campaign, we already discussing that the potential of basically updating our 43-101, which is also something that could be quite positive for us.
Yeah, I think that your resource was figured under a gold price of 1,300 or something like that, I believe, if I'm not wrong.
And yeah.
And so we might see, that would be one of the things I guess shareholders should keep their eyes on, investors should keep their eyes on, is this updated 43-101 number that might be coming out very soon once you get these assays in.
Yeah.
And then your infrastructure is quite good up there, I believe, considering the fact that you're way far north in northern BC,
yeah,
right? Your infrastructure,
yeah,
is very solid, very good. Essentially, you're well-funded, are you, through the end of this year, or you'll need to raise some money next year probably?
Now we're completely funded for this year and the entire of the next calendar year.
Oh,
so, you know, we're very good on that side of things. We're completely funded for our 15,000 meter drilling program at South Cassiar at the high grade for next year.
Oh, that's good. That's really good. So you're well funded.
Yeah.
So in summing up, then, what would you say we should really be watching for? What should investors really be keyed in on?
Yeah, and just to mention the infrastructure, you know, the resource itself sits literally next to the highway. We have a mill. Most of the resource is less than 100 meters deep and outcrops in some parts. And for the most part, there's no overburden. We have multiple access roads. We have a camp. So we have really outstanding infrastructure. And just to give you an idea or an example on how efficient and how helpful this infrastructure is, we are, this drilling campaign, 5,000 meters, we are drilling at $160 Canadian dollars per meter all in.
Wow.
That's a testament of, despite you thinking, you know, Northern BC might be remote, that all this infrastructure and how close it is to our targets really makes it very efficient to explore our 56,000 hectare land package.
Now, I just have to ask you this, and we're really out of time now, but as I look at the cross-section of your deposit, it looks like, as I think you alluded to it, the stripping ratio is going to be very low. I would think the economics should be very positive. Are there any thoughts about coming out with some sort of an economic study, a PEA or something on the project?
Yes, I'm already thinking about that. I think once we finalize our decision about the resource updates, I think that will be the next obvious step, and that's very exciting. But you know, that's just part of the story. I think the drill results that will be coming out over the next few weeks will continue to make us very excited about the bulk tonnage resource. I think people need to think as well about what we have at South Cassiar at the high grade part of our property.
Yes.
And think about the potential that we have there. We already have an historical resource that is very high grade, and there's multiple veins already identified. And these systems usually can be very, very big. So that's something that people should bear in mind. So there's really two really big stories here: the growth of the bulk tonnage resource, mm-hmm. as well as the high grade for next year.
Yeah, indeed. Higher grade is right. And looking at this sort of historical resource, we're looking at 18 grams, 24 grams, things like that. Very exciting, Marco. We are out of time. This is certainly one I'm going to be watching very carefully. And I think especially as next year gets underway and you start looking to the south, those high grade things, you know, people like high grade numbers. That's what gets
Absolutely.
Markets excited, no doubt about it. Well, thank you so much, Marco, for being with us. And we'll look
thank
forward
you,
to keeping up the story as we go forward. Well, that is it for this segment, folks. But don't go away, because Lynn Alden will be with me right after the break. And Lynn is going to talk about the issue. Well, what should investors be focused more on? The forces of inflation or deflation in these uncertain times. So don't go away. We'll be right back with Lynn Alden.
Voice America is available on your Google connected device.
Okay, Google, play Turning Hard Times into Good Times podcast on iHeartRadio.
Try it today.
NV Gold Corp, trading under NVX on the TSX and NVGLF on the OTC, is a gold exploration company focused on uncovering the next multi-million ounce gold deposit in North America. With an aggressive exploration season ahead in 2020, a tight share structure, strong management ownership, key strategic investors including Eric Sprott, a globally recognized technical team, technical coverage from industry gold experts, and cash in its treasury. Visit nvgoldcorp.com to learn more on this exciting story.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Lynn Alden. Lynn has a background as an engineer, and she's also been involved in finance for the last number of years, has really gained a lot of notoriety, and I think for rightfully so. Her calls have been very solid, and she has certainly gained the respect and attention of most of the major financial networks. And so we're really pleased and honored to have her with us again. Her website is Lynn Alden, Lynn, A-L-D-E-N, .com. And there you can get a lot of very valuable free information. Her thoughts about the markets, I think, very valuable. And she also has a pay-for service as well that I've recently signed up for, also very much worth a very reasonable price, I might add. Lynn, thanks for joining us again today.
Hey, thanks for having me again. Glad to be here.
It's really good to have you, and really, it's an honor. And I've titled today's show "Why Inflation Is on the Horizon." Now, that's my thought. I have a lot of friends that push back on that, who are saying, "Don't you know, Taylor, that debt is inherently deflationary, and can't you see we're going in debt like never before?" Exponential creation of money out of nothing. Well, it's not out of nothing, it's out of debt. So there is dollars floating around, but there's also debt on the other side of the equation, on the other side of the ledger. So what are your thoughts now in terms of this particular point in time? What are you most concerned about? Which side of the argument?
So long term, I do think we're heading towards an inflationary trend. We've been in a 40-year period of disinflation. So we still had positive inflation, but it was lower and lower, from the 80s to the 90s, over this past 40-year period. And there are some structural forces of deflation. So that's things like demographics are aging and slowing. Debt levels have gotten very high. And also technology, especially software, has been a very deflationary force, as has been labor offshoring. So we have these kind of inherently structural deflationary trends. Countering that is, the aggressive monetary policy that they've had over this period of time. So, deeply flat interest rates, so roughly zero interest rates, they're actually negative when adjusted for inflation, as well as very large fiscal deficits. And when it comes to, debt, There's of course different types of debt. So private debt is in many ways different from public debt issued by the federal government. Mm-hmm. And so one thing to keep in mind this year is that in previous decades, whenever the federal government increased their debt, what they basically did was they issued treasuries and someone buys those treasuries. So someone that they could have invested in something else instead invests in treasuries.
Uh-huh.
And so then they, of course, run the deficit somewhere else. And so what they're basically doing is they're extracting capital from somewhere in the economy and injecting it back somewhere else in the economy. And mm-hmm. But what's different, in this past, especially this past year, this is kind of trend that we're going on, is that now they're not extracting it from the economy. The economy is already very saturated with treasuries, the foreign sector is not really buying treasuries either at any kind of large scale compared to how much we're issuing. So the Federal Reserve is creating new bank reserves to buy those treasuries, and so basically what we're doing is we're not extracting that capital from the economy, but we still are injecting it into the economy with these large deficits, and so that tends to increase the broad money supply. In a way that not even 2007 and 2008 increased it at this pace.
Yeah, and so I guess you'd call that monetization of debt, right? And
what? Essentially, yes.
And so, how much of it is being funded by the Fed by money created out of nothing? Do you have a sense of that?
Yes, it depends on what time period you look at. Over the past year or so, that more than $2 trillion in treasuries have gotten onto the Fed's balance sheet. So it's been more than half of the issuance over the past year. And then they've also assisted the commercial banking sector in buying treasuries as well. And so that's actually another way that it gets kind of, spent mm-hmm. without being extracted. Whereas on the other hand, we've seen the percent of treasuries owned by the foreign sector go down substantially. Not because they've aggressively sold, but they just haven't been buying. So as the debt has gone up, the kind of static amount that is owned by the foreign sector has become a smaller percentage. So a greater percentage of it is winding up in the Fed balance sheet.
What rational reason would there be to own treasuries other than you need liquidity? And I guess pension funds and so forth, they have to, I don't know. I mean, when you have negative real rates, why would anybody in their right mind want to or have to buy treasuries?
So there are a couple of reasons. Some institutions are mandated to for risk reasons. Like, there's mm-hmm. There's kind of mandates and frameworks that have been in place for years or decades. So they have to have capital somewhere and they put some of it in the treasuries. And it also depends on where you look on the curve. So, for example, investors on the long end of the curve have done well this year because as interest rates went down, they had a lot of capital appreciation. Mm-hmm. That was kind of a speculative, kind of hedge or trading investment decision. Some of the people that think we're going to get deeper deflation before we have inflation might, for example, buy the long end of the treasury curve, mm-hmm. thinking that rates might fall, even that the long end might go all the way to zero or even negative as it has in some European countries, for example, and they would get a big capital gain from that. Mm-hmm. So there is still some speculation there. And in addition, if you look at how the 401k industry evolved, most funds now, people are signed up automatically for 401k injections when they get a new employer. And most of that goes into target date funds now. So that goes into the S&P 500. It goes into bond funds. It goes into this kind of inherently kind of diversified pie chart of assets. Mm-hmm. It's almost all stocks and bonds. And so there's this kind of constant trickle of new money into things like treasuries.
Mm-hmm. I think maybe the definition of inflation is always important, because I think most people think of inflation as, you know, the CPI, a number the government puts out that I think, frankly, is somewhat bogus. It's not necessarily real. You know, they started hedonic pricing long about Ronald Reagan's term, and substitution. They do all kinds of things, gimmicks. John Williams, an economist that we have on our show from time to time, an independent economist who's been around for quite a few years, tracks the inflation rate, and from his work suggests that, you know, we're seeing inflation rates of closer to 7 or 8%. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that, but if you look at some of the things you can't import into the United States, like college education or medical costs and so forth and so on, I don't know. But on the other hand, I'm wondering, the Austrian school, they look at inflation or deflation simply in terms of the money supply. And we certainly have seen, you could argue, inflation in asset prices, in housing, in stock markets, in the bond market we just referred to. Is that not one form of inflation when money is created, that, you know, it isn't counted or considered inflation? But what are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. I just had a newsletter on this subject, and so I broke it down into three types of inflation. So one is monetary inflation, as you point out, the Austrians term it, and that's just growth of the money supply itself. And so that's actually been very rapid this year. That's been over 20% this year alone. Over the past several years, depending on exactly what time period you look at, has been in the high single digits. So in the 7, 8, or 9% range, depending on what time frame you're looking at. Mm-hmm. And so that we do have monetary inflation. And that can come either from bank lending or from the previous process I described, which is running very large fiscal deficits that are being monetized for the most part. So that's why we've seen such a rapid increase in broad money supply this year. Mm-hmm. The second type would be asset price inflation. We've also seen that. So, for example, the valuations of equities, real estate, bonds, things like that, they've generally kept up with that monetary inflation. And then when you look at consumer price inflation, by some measures, that's the only area that's lagged to some degree. But of course, we've had, you know, pretty strong inflation, consumer price inflation in healthcare, education, childcare, all sorts of services that, as you point out, can't be outsourced. And that's been partially offset by deflation in things like electronics and software that's kind of replaced a lot of our devices and kind of enhanced productivity. But then we also, of course, have, you know, as you point out, errors of measuring it. We've also enjoyed a period of relative commodity abundance just because, you know, we've had unprofitable shale oil supply come online in the past decade. We had big copper developments in the past decade that we're still kind of enjoying to this day. We're not really running into inherent scarcity in most commodities. So there's a couple triggers that could cause even CPI as currently reported to increase, and that would either, you know, potentially be an increase in broad commodity prices if you start to get pockets of scarcity, or you could have, for example, labor onshoring. So we've had, you know, it's actually been about a decade now where the offshoring trend has been slowing down, and now it looks like it's showing signs of reversing, which is partially a political outcome. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely something to watch, that if we start reshoring labor, that could show up in broad prices.
Mm-hmm. So right now, you've made the point, I think the last time we had you on, you talked about the need now for the need for fiscal stimulus, that monetary stimulus doesn't work. I guess the reason is because banks aren't lending, can't lend really. They're not lending, I suppose, the people that are credit worthy don't need the money. And then who would want to lend as a banker in this environment? It would be far and few between, I would think, given the, especially since COVID. But do you really see the necessity now? I believe you do, from what I've read before and what you've said before, that you really see the need for more fiscal stimulus. And if that's the case, what do you think that's in the cards as we as a new administration takes over?
So I think one thing they have to do is target things better. And so one thing I pointed out, for example, is that over the past couple decades, we've reduced corporate taxes, which is good, and we've reduced certain other types of taxes. However, payroll taxes have been very high, and healthcare expenses, that are mostly burdened by, employers are the ones paying big chunks of that for their employees. They've skyrocketed. That's been a type of inflation. Mm-hmm. And so what we've seen is a bifurcation between companies that are not labor intensive and companies that are very labor intensive. So if you have a software company, you're enjoying the lower corporate tax rates, but you're unburdened by the fact that payroll taxes are still high and that, healthcare expenses for employees are still high. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you're running a company that, makes physical products or employs a lot of people, especially if you, cover their healthcare and, they're not just minimum wage employees, they're actually, skilled employees that are well compensated. That's a very tough business model, and that's where a lot of the businesses have had to really lay off people and outsource their labor. Mm-hmm. So there are kind of things they could do, such as, cut payroll taxes and things like that, that would be stimulatory on some of the businesses that have been kind of hardest hit by things over the past decade. So I think, policymakers are going to have a choice in the next, several years, which is, they can do nothing, and we're going to start to see kind of increasing defaults and probably eventually have a banking system crash, and it ultimately is going to end in with a devaluation of the currency in one way or the other. And the decision is whether or not they want to do that in kind of a healthy and targeted way, or whether they want to end up doing it in a messier way. With the current kind of political outlook, it appears that we're going to have a Biden victory, and it appears we're probably going to have a red Senate. So my base case is probably not a lot of major action over the next 2 years.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if a red or Republican Senate might be more inclined to go along with the tax cuts on labor. I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. So do you see a sort of a divided government like that, with the Senate remaining Republican and the White House being Democrat, as making it more difficult for stimulus, for fiscal stimulus then, I would imagine? Is that your thinking?
Yeah, it takes some of the larger stimulus options off the table, and of course, that people have different opinions on whether that's good or bad, but just from analyzing asset mm-hmm. prices of different things, it's just a variable to consider. But I do think they're probably going to be forced to do something, just because we would eventually have kind of probably another wave of civil unrest if this were to play out with zero stimulus, right? Because mm-hmm. you're going to start to see people get evicted in greater numbers and things like that. And so there's this kind of this natural socio-political feedback loop that happens. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, even though we had a red Senate, we had a massive stimulus bill earlier this year. Mm-hmm. And that was just because the economic damage was so severe, and we came into this already so fragile. And so I'm expecting they're probably going to do something small in the years ahead. But either way it plays out, I think the key thing is to have some degree of diversification and to be in assets that don't require stimulus, but that would also serve as a hedge against currency devaluation in the case, that you do get stimulus.
Currency devaluation could be a frightening prospect, I think, in terms of inflation, and would be not a good thing. So are you more concerned now about deflation? I kind of hear that from you, that deflation in the traditional sense of CPI.
So my long term outlook is inflationary. Mm-hmm. I do think that between now and the spring, I'm not expecting a ton of CPI inflation during, say, the next 3 months or so.
Mm-hmm.
Just because we have this current COVID wave, we're entering the winter. Some of the vaccines, they're more of a 2021 story if they pan out. And just because, we'll see what happens with the election contestation. We'll see what happens with stimulus over this time period. So I'm not expecting kind of major devaluations to occur in the next 3 months or so. Mm-hmm. I would say I'm kind of neutral to slightly disinflationary, in kind of the near term. But mm-hmm. I remain mostly positioned towards a longer term inflationary outlook. But I do keep a degree of cash on the side of, you know, in allocated in different portfolios to take advantage of any deflationary shocks or things that might happen along those lines.
Yeah. Well, Ray Dalio says cash is trash, and I can kind of understand that, but maybe not as much. And yet, and certainly, we've all been through these, sudden the bottom falls out of the equity market, and we're stuck with things we just wish that we had the foresight of building some cash before the bottom falls out, for sure. So 2021, I mean, the equity market, when it heard the Pfizer news a week ago or so, got really excited. I mean, I saw $1,500 up on the Dow before the market opened. I mean, the Fed, though, is going to pump money. It's got to pump money because there's nobody, as you pointed out, lending to the, or at least there's a shortage of lenders. So even if there's not a lot of fiscal stimulus, there's going to be huge deficits. You would agree with that, I guess, right? And then the Fed is going to have to print, which I guess if you don't get the fiscal stimulus, then the money just keeps piling into the equity markets and into real estate or whatever, and you have this growing disparity between rich and poor.
Yeah, so my base case is that certain assets are still likely to do well. I'd be careful of some of the most risky plays, things like commercial real estate or some of the airlines, movie theaters, things like that. I do, however, like some of the cyclicals, whether it's, things like, I like airports. I don't like airlines, but I like airports because they have a wider economic moat. I like some of the, steel makers. I like some of the more industrial kind of cyclical companies as part of a diversified portfolio. And so I still like precious metals. I like an allocation to Bitcoin as well. So I having kind of multiple bets placed on multiple different asset classes in the event that, whether or not we get stimulus or not, these are things that are, well constructed to survive, over the next year or so, regardless of how many, evictions happen or how, whether or not we get a deflationary crunch before we get inflation or whatever the kind of outcome might be. Some things that are just inherently strong that I think can hold up well.
And you, how often do you publish for your paid subscribers?
So my base case is every 2 weeks we have a report out, and then sometimes during market volatility or unusual events, I publish an extra piece.
Yeah, and your service is very reasonable. I can't remember exactly what I paid, but what is it?
It's for the full year, it's $199.
Very reasonable. It is excellent, no doubt about it. You mentioned Bitcoin, and I have to ask you because you put up, I haven't had a chance to read it. In fact, I just noticed it. You published it on just on the 12th, so just very recently. 7 misconceptions about Bitcoin. Could you share some of them with us, perhaps?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is a very controversial asset class, and especially between there's Bitcoin investors that hate gold, there's gold investors that hate Bitcoin, and I'm in the camp where I have both, and so I originally covered Bitcoin with a piece back in 2017, and I was neutral to bearish on it, so I took no position. There were a lot of risks at the time. And we, of course, had that blow off top that then we had like a big, kind of a 2.5 year correction consolidation. Earlier this year in April, Bitcoin, during that big kind of March sell off, Bitcoin fell. And then during the recovery phase, it was about 6,900. And I went long in the research service. And I've been kind of providing a bull case since then. So right now, as of today, it's over 17,000. But of course, it's a very volatile asset. The misconceptions mainly revolve around how liquid it is or how volatile it is whether or not it can be banned. And so, I did a two-part piece on it. So a piece earlier in July kind of set the overall foundation for why it can be considered to have a store of value effect as a network effect, which some people – from the gold world, understandably, are skeptical about Bitcoin's storage value. But that first article kind of addresses why that's been working out for Bitcoin over the past year. And then the second piece just kind of addresses a miscellaneous emails or questions that are pretty common, such as whether or not Bitcoin is energy efficient, whether or not Bitcoin's transactions can scale enough, things like that are often kind of questions or risks that people have before deciding to have a small Bitcoin position.
What I mean, does Bitcoin have any intrinsic value? I mean, I own gold because it is real. It's something I can hold in my hand. I can use it probably if under certain circumstances as a medium of exchange if need be. I mean, I guess as an old guy, Bitcoin is a little hard to understand. My son Scott understands it better, and he tells me that I should buy what is it, BTG? Here I have it. GBTC, I guess, is a way to buy it. It's not, what is it, like an ETF, I guess, right? Are you familiar with that?
It's kind of. It's a trust. It's not an ETF, but it's a fund that owns Bitcoin.
A trust.
It's kind of like a closed-end fund.
Okay. And risks with that? Do you have an opinion on that?
So I have a small position in GBTC, mainly because it's one of the few ways to get Bitcoin exposure in a brokerage account, mm-hmm. whereas most of the ways to get direct Bitcoin exposure are outside of brokerage accounts, in exchanges or things like that. So I have a cold storage Bitcoin position, but then I also have a small position in GBTC. Mm-hmm. And as far as intrinsic value is concerned, so one analogy I make to gold is that gold, you know, if you look at the demand for it, about 10% of it is in industrial, and the rest is jewelry and as a store of value. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the price premium that gold enjoys is based on its unique characteristics that make it ideal as a store of value. And so it mostly benefits from the strong network effect that we know that it has very long multi-thousand-year history of being perceived as a store of value, and that, you know, we could always find someone that would take our gold for a certain amount of value mm-hmm. If we needed mm-hmm. to. So with Bitcoin, essentially, it's the entire value of it is based on that network effect. So it has no industrial utility, but what it enjoys is the fact that it's scarce, and compared to every other cryptocurrency, it's far more secure because all of them have lower hash rates protecting their blockchain. So they're actually pretty cheap for a large entity to try to attack, whereas Bitcoin itself has so much security and so much hash power that it's very challenging for any sort of entity to attack it and try to break the blockchain. And mm-hmm. so it becomes kind of the only viable cryptocurrency that can be, you know, considered to be a store of value. And so one of the advantages of it is that it's accessible to people around the world that for many of them don't have access to gold even. So, for example, mm-hmm. cryptocurrencies are particularly popular in emerging markets. And, you know, for places that have had a lot of currency failure, one of the things they can do is they can put their funds into Bitcoin, and it's actually at that point it becomes more internationally tradable than even gold. So, for example, if you were to try to move gold, you know, internationally through an airport, you'd mm-hmm. run into issues and questions and things like that. Whereas Bitcoin is much easier to transfer internationally. So it has certain advantages. Like you can think of it as a payment network, and you know, the reason that there's never been another cryptocurrency to come along and kind of take market share from it out of the thousands is that, you know, Bitcoin just has a much stronger network effect, similar to Facebook and similar to some of these kind of social sites where it just keeps kind of growing and taking market share.
Mm-hmm. What about government and central banks? It doesn't seem as though they would want to let their privileges go and be compete and have a competitor like Bitcoin. Aren't they likely to try to grab a hold of that or somehow? Can they do it? Would it be possible?
That's a risk to consider, and that's been Bridgewater founder Ray Dalio's main concern is that if it does well, governments will ban it. And there, of course, is a precedent for the U.S. government banning gold, for example.
Sure.
And a couple points to consider. One is that it's becoming a pretty large asset class, and now it's on two publicly traded companies' balance sheets, so mm-hmm. MicroStrategy and Square. It's also increasingly owned by hedge funds. You know, investors like Stanley Druckenmiller are now in it. And in addition, we have major custodians like Fidelity building out custody solutions for institutional-grade clients. And so at that level, it's basically getting so entrenched that it, you know, the larger it gets, kind of the harder it is to ban. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, even if they were to ban it, that creates a game theory effect where another country can say, okay, we're not going to ban it. Mm-hmm. Come build your businesses here. You can run your changes here. And so I do think that banning is potentially kind of one of those kind of intermediate term risks. But long term, the network is pretty resilient to individual governments trying to ban it.
Yeah, I can't imagine governments not wanting to get, I mean, they certainly want to know what transactions you're involved with and would want to get a piece of the action through the tax code.
Yeah.
No matter where you're at, I suppose, right? And so I did buy a few shares of this GBTC this morning at $19.69. I look on my screen now, it's $1.28. Not bad for one day's work, I guess. work, in quotes.
Yeah, it's very volatile. It'll probably go up and down big.
Yeah. Well, Lynn, it's just really, really great to have you with us again. Always a lot of great insights. Certainly, I would just suggest to my listeners that they pay attention to what you're doing. LynnAlden.com, go there and sign up for Lynn's free letter for sure. But more than that, consider subscribing to her service for under $200 a year. It's pretty hard to beat that, I must say. Lynn, thank you so much for being with us, and all the best to you. And we'll look to do it again sometime soon, I hope.
Yep. Best to you as well. Thanks for having me.
All right. You bet. All right, folks. Well, that is all the time we have for this week. Next week, John Rubino will be with me, as well as Michael Oliver and Dr. Quentin Henning. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Novo Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. Novo has recently partnered with Sumitomo Corporation of Japan to evaluate, advance, and develop the company's Australian gold projects. With over $40 million in cash and $60 million committed from Sumitomo, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.